Okay, so let's remind ourselves what exactly we were doing, especially since we didn't have anything last week, and then we'll move forward with today's topic. So what we saw is initially we saw the transmission of Torah, both the written law and the oral law. What was given from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe, how Moshe passed it down, how that was further passed down in each generation. We then saw not only how the Torah was passed down, but how it was expanded upon in a way that didn't add to it, rather allowed for a natural expansion of the principles that we had received, right? We didn't receive a Torah that was... We obviously received the Torah that could not change, but we received a Torah which has a natural development or an expansion based upon the divine principles therein. And we discussed that topic in depth in the last couple classes. We also saw the nature of that development from the recording of the Mishnah to the recording of the Gemara and further. We saw that in each several, you know, groups of generations, something slightly different is going on, but essentially what they have in common is each generation is looking at what the previous generation did, analyzing it and interpreting it, trying to clarify what exactly the intention is, right? Then expanding upon it, expanding again in a natural way, not adding to it so much as trying to see how the principles naturally expand. And then additionally, they determine in a case of argument or of debate who exactly we're meant to follow lehalacha practically. So you have the record of the Mishnah, which is the primary teachings of the Tanaim, and that essentially is composed of everything that we received from Moshe, as well as answers to questions that came up after Moshe died, based upon the principles that Moshe gave us. So he gave us a certain amount of laws and a certain amount of principles. And if a question had come up that we didn't receive explicitly, we couldn't just make up what we wanted to do. We had to go back to what we had and ask, well, if we know this is the law in circumstance A, how exactly is circumstance B different than A? And what would the same law look like in a different scenario? So it's not changing anything. It's asking, based upon the same principles, what they might look like in a scenario that had yet to be discussed. That's what the Mishnah did for those laws and that Masorah that had come before it. That's what the Gemara did for the Mishnah. It would analyze the Mishnah, try to clarify the Mishnah's intention. Then it would expand upon the principles mentioned in the Mishnah, and it would also tell us who we follow practically, lehalacha. That's what the Rishonim did to the Gemara, analyze the Gemara and try to explain to us what exactly the Gemara is talking about. And it would expand upon the principles in the Gemara, and the scenarios, the situations that the Rishonim were encountering were so very, very different from the Gemara's scenarios. We could be talking about up to, you know, between 800 and 1,000 years later in some instances. And then they would also determine, in a case of debate, who exactly we follow practically lehalacha. Okay, so if what became a trend, so to speak, amongst the Rishonim was not necessarily to write their own work which models the Gemara and insert their own opinions or their own conclusions. Rather, what some of them would do is just take all of the conclusions based upon how they understood the Gemara and make independent works just of that. Okay, so we said the Mishnah records several different discussions, and then the Gemara records discussions around the Mishnah, and sometimes the Rishonim record discussions around the Gemara. But what many of the Rishonim began to do was they would read every Gemara, every sugya, and they would understand it however they understood it, and then they would try to tell us who we should be following, lehalacha, and also what that halacha would be in a circumstance perhaps never discussed in the Gemara, based on their understanding of it. Perhaps most famously, the one who did this in a very clear and organized and codified fashion was the Rambam. Now, you have the Bahag and the Rif, who also just wanted to highlight the halachic conclusions of the Gemara. But instead of the Rambam recording the Gemara and just telling you how he understood things, he said, I'm going to take all of my conclusions from all of how I read the Gemara, how I understood it, who we need to follow the halacha, and what the halacha would be, even in circumstances that the Gemara didn't discuss. And instead of just writing an abbreviated Gemara with my conclusions, I'm going to organize my conclusions from across shas by topic, and I'm going to put it in one organized series for you that he called the Mishnah Torah. So that's how we reach the halacha. That's how we reach the halacha. So the Rambam did that. The Rif did that in a slightly different fashion. And the Rosh did that. And these were the three most prominent Rishonim whose halachic analysis of the Gemara was accepted broadly amongst different parts of Klal Yisrael. Now, there were others who did this. They were either less all-inclusive in terms of their subject matter, or they were just not as widely accepted, practically speaking, in different communities. But you do have many other Rishonim who are drawing their halachic conclusions from the Gemara. The Rosh, the Rambam, and the Rif put a specific emphasis on giving you the practical takeaway, lemaisa, from the Gemara. And their conclusions were adopted very, very broadly within Klal Yisrael. Now, one person came along and said, okay, well, we have several, three perhaps pillars of halacha, but several Rishonim now who have all done similar things in analyzing the Gemara, drawing the conclusions, as well as expanding further. So what do we do now that we have so many debates around the conclusions of those debates? So there was a specific figure who said, okay, I'm going to work through all of these sugyas, I'm going to bring the primary major opinions, and my leading halachic principle is going to be the majority. So if you have a debate between the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh, and you have the Rambam and the Rif on one side, and the Rosh on the other side, I'm going to follow the Rambam and the Rif. If you have the Rambam and the Rosh on one side, and the Rif on the other side, I'm going to follow the Rambam and the Rosh. If you have the Rosh and the Rif on one side, so this is a bit of an oversimplification, but roughly he gathered together the prominent, roughly speaking, he gathered the prominent opinions found in the Rishonim, and he collected them all in one place, for all different topics, okay, and informed us that we should basically be practicing like the majority of those opinions, okay. That was done by someone named Rabbi Yaakov ben Harosh, meaning he was the actual son of the Rosh. It's awkward when he has to paskin against his father, but he was the son of the Rosh, Rabbi Yaakov ben Harosh, and we may know him more commonly as the Tur. We know him as the Tur because he organized all of halacha that he was concluding into four boxes or categories called Turim. Okay? So the Arba Turim was his halachic work, and that's exactly what he did. And he would bring down the topic, and he'd say, here's how the Rishonim side on this topic, and this is basically what we should do lehalacha, the arbitur. Okay, what were the categories that he broke halacha down into? We said the Rambam, meaning the Mishnah had six categories. Right? The Mishnah had six categories. We spoke about them Right? Oh, we started with Zra'im, and then Moed, and then Nashim, then Nezikim, then Kodshim, then Taharot. The Rambam in his conclusions broke it down into 14 categories. Right? The Mishnah Torah, or the Yad HaChazaka, which we call Yad because Yad is Yod Daled, 14 categories. The Torah had 4 categories. Does anyone know what those 4 categories are? So the first one is just is kind of the halachas that come up on a daily or weekly year cycle, the daily cycle, the year cycle, and that's what's called Or HaChaim. Not Or HaChaim, that's a perush on the Torah, but Or HaChaim, you know, the way that you live your life, basically. And that's, you know, that it starts with what you need to do in the morning, and davening, and then brachot, and then Shabbos, and chagim, and okay. Right? Then you have Yoredeya. Yoredeya is a lot of the Isser V'Heter questions. That's where Kashrut is. That's where Nida is. Right? Then you have Choshen Mishpat. So that it's everything that has to do, Isser V'Heter is like what's forbidden and what's allowed. You know, this you can eat, this you cannot eat. This you can do, this you cannot do. Then you have Choshen Mishpat, and that deals with the Jewish legal system. And then you have Evan Ha'ezer, which has a lot to do with men and women together. What's you know, the guidelines? What's usher? What's mutter? The second one was Yoredeya. Then you have Choshen Mishpat. Then you have Evan Ha'ezer. That's his categorization. The arbiter that became very, very, very popular, and then a couple hundred years later. Two figures independently and simultaneously decided to do roughly the same thing, which was to take the halacha that the Tur had recorded, bring as much background and analysis from the original sources that they could bring. So, for example, if the Torah said, you know, this is the halacha, or the Rishonim say this and this is the halacha, they would say, okay, well, let's start, you know, with the Gemara. The Gemara says this. There are 3 ways of understanding the Gemara. This is how this person interpreted. This is how that person interpreted. This is a debate between these two people. They would bring the analysis. It was like a full commentary and elucidation of basically the legwork that the Torah had put in that he didn't necessarily record. And sometimes within their analysis of the sugya, they reached a different conclusion than the Torah reached, or they just had more to offer that had come up over the last 200 years. So the first, I guess, there were 2 people doing this simultaneously. Okay, who was doing it simultaneously? Anyone know? Rav Yosef Karo, excellently, and the Ramo, Rav Moshe Israelis. Okay, simultaneously they decided, hey, you know, it would be a good idea to write a full commentary and illumination of the sugyas behind the halacha in the Torah. Okay, Rav Yosef Karo's commentary was called? Well, his commentary on the Torah was called the Beit Yosef. Okay, Rav Moshe Israelis's commentary was called? The Darkei Moshe. The Darkei Moshe. You have the Beit Yosef and you have the Darkei Moshe. They're commentaries on the Torah. Now, like I said, very often they concluded based on their analysis of the Gemara and the Rishonim, they reached different conclusions than the Torah. Each of them respectively decided to then record their conclusions in an abbreviated and organized fashion, so you didn't have to read the entirety of their summary of the analysis of the sugya in order to know what to do. So, Rav Yosef Karo took his conclusions that he reached in the Beit Yosef, which is his commentary on the Torah, and he wrote one concise, at least relatively speaking, concise halachic work modeling the Torah's 4 categories, and that is known as the Shulchan Aruch. Now, the Rama did the same thing on the Torah in the Darkei Moshe and wanted to also put out his halachic conclusions, but when he heard about the work that that Rav Yosef Karo was doing, he thought it would be more effective to just take Rav Yosef Karo's work and interject when he disagreed or had an elaboration, right? So that's why the Ramah, you don't really have an independent set of Sfarim called the Ramah, but when you read the Shulchan Aruch, you'll see a Hey Gimel Hey, and that is when the Ramah is commenting on what the Shulchan Aruch is saying based on a different conclusion that he drew from the same process. Okay, similar processes have been followed since then. The Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah became the staple of accepted halacha, broadly speaking, in the Ashkenazi and Sephardi communities. The Ramah in the Ashkenazi community and the Shulchan Aruch in the Sephardi community. Now, it's important to mention something that people miss. Okay, what binds us in such a strict or absolute fashion to the Piskei Halacha of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah is not because of some divine given authority to the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. What binds us to their Psak Halacha is the fact that as a broad community of Ashkenazim and Sephardim, we accepted their conclusions. Yeah.
So, like, they followed the Torah until they made this one, and then they all just like moved away from that and went to Shulchan Aruch. Just
something. Yeah. Well, very often they were the same. They were similar to the same conclusions, okay. And very often they were just elaborations that weren't in the Torah, but where they departed in their conclusions from the tour, the Sephardi community, broadly speaking, except not including Teimanim, who followed by and large the Rambam's Piskei Halacha, but the Sephardi community broadly accepted the Shulchan Aruch Psak, and the Ashkenazi community broadly accepted the Ramah's Psak. You had less of the distinction, I think. I could be mistaken. I'm not 100% sure to what degree there was a distinction between the two communities at that point in time. I'm not confident, right? So now, what generated the chiyuv, what generated the commitment, was the degree to which it was commonly accepted in our communities. There was no, meaning after Ravina and Rav Ashi recorded the Gemara, the Geonim, the Rishonim who came afterward, were not allowed to argue with what they said. Right? They had a level of authority that can be attributed to the fact that Torah Shebaal Peh was still an oral Masorah, or the utilization of the Yud Gimel Midot for extracting Halacha that afterward we didn't really have. So many are of the opinion that after Ravina and Rav Ashi, we couldn't argue. We can expand, we can understand, we can be mefarish. We could say things are different. Right? We couldn't argue with their conclusions. We could say that, perhaps we could say that was the correct conclusion, but this is a time-oriented conclusion and things are different. That has been done. But that distinction doesn't exist between the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. So after the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, within 50 years and 100 years and 150 years of their publications, you had many widely respected Rabbanim disagreeing with their conclusions in notable places. Perhaps that served as like the standard for what we did, but that didn't stop someone like the Shach, for example, at learning the Sugya and disagreeing with the Shulchan Aruch's conclusion. He was allowed to do that. By and large, the community follows the Shulchan Aruch. The Sephardi community follows the Shulchan Aruch. By and large, the Ashkenazi community follows the Ramah. But there are the instances where the most widely accepted Rabbanim, who came afterward, disagreed, and their conclusions became a mainstay within either their particular community or more broadly the Ashkenazi community or the Ashkenazi community or Sephardi community within the countries that they're speaking about. And that's how on the one hand the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah became a standard, a staple, a pillar in all of Shmirat Halacha. On the other hand, you do see across the board times that the Sephardi community doesn't paskin like the Shulchan Aruch, and times that the Ashkenazi community is not paskin like the Ramah, based upon the widely accepted poskim who came afterward in their community. So some of the most notable ones would be the Shach and the Taz, or the Magen Avraham, we may be familiar with, the Chatam Sofer, we may be familiar with, the Levush was perhaps the first notable commentary, but Bar Plugta argument, argument upon the Shulchan Aruch, and then every 100 to 200 years, we kind of have this period where we stop for a second, we summarize everything that had, come before us, and we say, okay, well, now that the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah say this, but the Prima Gadim says this, and the Magen Avraham says this, and the Shach says this, and the Taz says this, and the Chatam Sofer says this. So what do we do, right? And so you have a kind of a summary of everything that came before with some practical guidance moving forward, where their goal is not necessarily just to record their own conclusions and whether they argue or not, but to summarize all that had come before them in order to give practical guidance for us to not get lost in the multiplicity of opinions, right? So most notably, those who did that really summarized everything that came before us and tried to give some practical guidance in the last, 100 to 150 years were two massive halachic works, and that is the Mishnah Brura. That's the Mishnah Brura. Right? And the Mishnah Brura, though, however, is only on the Or HaChaim. That's very important to keep in mind. There are three parts of halacha that he doesn't comment on. Right? So the Mishnah Brura did this on the Or HaChaim. And the Aruch HaShulchan did this on all the Shulchan. Okay? And what they did was they really summarized what came before them and gave practical guidance for our generation. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan did this in a different fashion than the Mishnah Brura. They had different methodologies in terms of how they went about drawing their conclusions. The Mishnah Brura tried to incorporate as many legitimate opinions as possible in one coherent way of following halacha. So when there was debate, if you could follow both or all three of the opinions, right? He would pitch a way to incorporate more opinions into one way of keeping the halacha. That was his goal. Because, these are all valid opinions, and nothing, it's not contradictory to keep them both. So you should try to integrate as many of these opinions as possible. The Aruch HaShulchan was a little bit more conservative when it came to his conclusions, and he would generally, in an instance of a debate, make a conclusive decision as to who you should follow, as opposed to saying try to follow as many as possible. Now, in our generation, we're seeing something very similar take place. Now, we see this kind of happening at a faster rate than we have historically, when you think about it, right? The gap between, the summaries and conclusions and a straightforward path forward is happening at an increasingly fast rate. Now this may, we may be able to attribute that to many different considerations. It may just be because our access to the written word is so much, easier. And so anyone who wants to can just, give it a try because they have a computer and they can, and they can print it. And you don't need a team of people who decide this is one of the most important books of all time. Let me handwrite all of this down to preserve it for future generations. But also what might be is the differences in society on a practical level between now and 100 and especially 200 years ago is probably greater than the 500 to 1,000 years that came before it, when you just think about how rapidly certain aspects of our society is changing, especially with the advent of technology. I mean, you consider the ease of travel, when you consider technological advances, when you consider all these things, and then especially with coming back to Israel, that was a major halachic consideration. So all of these things are causing so many new situations to come to light. Every decade is so different, right? The changes that happen in a couple decades now, sociologically, are probably the changes that would happen over a couple centuries historically. So now we have to be careful, because that doesn't mean that human nature is changing all that much. It could just mean that based on we're just acting differently in different societies. So you can't just totally uproot all of halacha. Oh, that was then, and this is now. Well, okay, so, you know, some, if not most, things stay constant, and it's for the rabbanim of that generation to try to determine, you know, what is the same and what is different. So you see now a couple people working on different works that kind of summarize all of halacha that came before them and give some practical guidance moving forward, right? So you have, in the Sephardi community, you had Rav Yitzchak Yosef doing this based upon the psak halacha of his father, Rav Avadia. You have Rav Melamed very notably doing this for all communities in Pnine Halacha. And you have a similar endeavor that you see through Rav Rimon in his Halacha Mimakora, slightly different methodologies, but all kind of fitting this criteria let's summarize everything that came before now and you know, give you some guidance moving forward and interject when there's something that may be different than it has been historically. Okay, so that is just kind of a recap, really, of all of our Mesorah of Torah Shebaal Peh, or I should say our Mesorah of Torah Shebaal Peh in Halacha. In Halacha. We really didn't talk about our Mesorah in Torah Shebaal Peh in Machshava. Okay, because also Machshava doesn't just come out of nowhere, right? This is also Mesorah for this. We'll talk about that Amir Tzashem in a future class. But what I want to do now with the rest of the class is to try to develop a better perspective on how Judaism, how Torah relates to debate, to argument, to differences of opinion. Because, as we noted, there are many differences of opinion that pertain to the halacha. Every generation, there seems to be an increased number of differences of opinion. You may be doing something that your friend does not do. Your friend may be doing something that you do not do. Maybe you would love to be doing what your friend is doing, and it frustrates you that apparently they're allowed to and you're not allowed to. And it's also conceptually and theologically difficult to wrap your mind around how you're obligated in the same Torah, and we have the same Mesorah, and something can be absolutely forbidden for you and totally fine for your friend. So we have to try to understand a little bit better, basically, what is our hashkafa as it pertains to debate historically in the halachic system. Many different opinions come about. We seem to embrace different opinions, but what did God want us to do? Why is it okay that we have two options for that? And why can't I choose which one I want to do? And how can they both be right? And okay, so these are some of the questions that come up around debate within a system that is trying to clarify what God wanted from us. To say that there's a debate in a human system is one thing. Okay, you know, this person saw it this way, this person saw it that way. I agree with this, I agree with that. So argument in the political system is not surprising nor theologically that troubling. Okay, human beings are trying to work out what the best way to live is, and And we may argue about what that is. But this is a godly system. And we're trying to continue doing what God wants us to do, so shouldn't there only be one answer to that? That's what we want to try to tackle now. So, is anyone familiar with ideas or statements within our Masorah that suggests a certain open-mindedness is not the right word, but a certain acceptance of a multiplicity of viewpoints as being legitimate? I'm familiar with an idea like that. I mean more like even within our Masorah, something that says there is more than one correct answer. Yeah. So interesting. So that's an example. That would be an example. And you're correct. I mean there are definitely different legitimate opinions. How do we know as a community today that there is an idea of multiple legitimate opinions? Yeah. Excellent. So this is one idea. Yeah.
Isn't it the thing that we talked about last week with like the 13 different tools that you use to read something from the Torah?
Amazing. So that's how we arrive at different conclusions. Absolutely. There's another Ma'amar Chazal that perhaps you're familiar with, which is called Elu ve'Elu Divrei Elokim Chaim. So the most famous statements of Chazal along these lines are Shivim Panim LaTorah, Shivim Panim LaTorah, and Elu ve'Elu Divrei Elokim Chaim. Right? So Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel have a debate, and we're like, oh, you know, who's right? Elu ve'Elu Divrei Elokim Chaim. They are both an accurate reflection of the word of the living God. Okay, so we have to understand what exactly that means. And the first step is just getting what we're saying and what we are not saying. We can say that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are both reflections of the word of God. We can even say that there are 70 legitimate interpretations of Torah. But it's very important that we draw the line somewhere. Okay, this is not an argument for relativism as it pertains to halacha or truth. Right? It is an argument for plurality as it pertains to halacha or truth. And there's a very big difference. Okay, relativism suggests that there is basically no objective right or wrong. That right and wrong is a subjective construct based on different perspectives and experiences. This is not what the Torah advocates. This is not what the Torah believes. This is not a reflection of our halachic system. Okay? Just because there is more than one answer, that does not make the truth subjective. It just means that there can be more than one answer which is objective. Okay, that's a formulation of the thought, but now let's kind of get into the details. Okay, there's a difference between saying anything could be correct as opposed to saying you are not limited to one correct avenue. Okay, so the Torah does not believe that anything is correct. In fact, there are many things, most things in fact, which are very Most things, in fact, which are very clearly not correct, not okay, not right, not truthful. That does not mean, however, that we are limited to one avenue of analysis. But we need to talk about how exactly this can be, theologically speaking. How can there be more than one right answer? So, one way of answering this question is the example that the Netziv brings. So the Netziv basically gives the following explanation. The Netziv says like this: when HaKadosh Baruch Hu was giving Moshe the Torah, not just the Torah Shebichtav, the Torah Shebaal Peh, he'd say, yeah, okay, this is Asa. This is what you need to do. This is Mutter. This is what you're allowed to do. Some things, Kadosh Baruch Hu would say to Moshe, this is a gray area. This is a gray area. It's not completely conclusive or objective which one is correct or incorrect. There are arguments for this side and arguments for that side. And that basically assumes that there's room for interpretation, and that's even an initial room for interpretation. Meaning that there was never, regarding what we're debating, there was never even a conclusive instruction from God's behalf that God sees it as nuanced and subject to interpretation and not conclusive. So when it is conclusive, right, he says. When it is conclusive, wrong, he says. And there is actually a domain which in and of itself is not conclusive, and that we are meant to debate the pros and the cons, or this side and that side, historically, in order to determine what we should keep. We're not arguing with God, so to speak. And we're not even arguing to try to figure out what God meant. God said it was a gray area. And that left room available for the sphere of debates that we are having now. That's one approach that you could take. I like to formulate that approach in the following way. I like to formulate that approach in the following way. I think it helps us conceptualize very nicely how differences in halacha can come about and be perfectly okay. Imagine that you are a carpenter. Okay, you're a carpenter, and you get an order. And the order says as follows. I would like for you to build for me something that I can sit on, made of wood that has four legs. Okay? So, what do you build?
Chair.
Maybe you build a chair. Maybe you build a stool. Maybe you build a bench. Maybe you build a wooden horse, apparently. Maybe you build a bed. Now, you might want to say, well, you could sit on a bed, but it's more common to lie on a bed, so maybe that's not the best interpretation of what they wanted. Okay, so we can get into it. But a bench and a chair? These, you know, you could say, well, a stool, you could sit on a stool, but maybe it's more for standing upon. So I don't want to say it's a bed. A bed is more common to lie upon. I don't want to say it's a stool. A stool is more common to stand upon. But a bench and a chair, these things are quite common to sit upon. So I'm going to assume. Okay. So how do you figure out what the client wanted? Okay, do they want a chair or do they want a bench or something else? How do you figure it out? Well, maybe what the answer is, the client didn't really care. Right? Maybe the client just wanted something wooden that they could sit upon with four legs, and it didn't make much of a difference to them whether or not it was a bench or a chair. Okay, so that's perhaps how we conceptualize this gray area within halacha. Right? When God wants something specific, he tells us. When God doesn't want something that is as precise or as specific, what does he do? He gives us the criteria that it needs to meet. Okay? Now, for whatever reason, you would think that this is the best manifestation of this criteria. They might think that that's the best manifestation of this criteria. But why is it that both of them can be legitimate practices? Because it wasn't conclusive to begin with. It was a list of criteria, in which case the question is, does it meet that criteria? Now, what happens if someone comes along and builds something that does not meet that criteria? They build a chair out of metal, or they build a bench with two legs, right? So that's wrong. right? That's where things fall outside the boundaries of the halacha. Just because there can be more than one correct thing doesn't mean that everything is correct. Okay? They didn't follow the criteria. It's metal. It has two legs. You can't sit upon it. Whatever the reason is, they diverged from the criteria. Okay. Now, slightly different is how you determine, maybe that needs to be like the last class, right? Like Asel Acharav, how you determine how you need to actually, you know, follow. This is more on the theological side of how there can be more than one correct viewpoint. Okay, that's the Nitziv. Milchachila, it was gray. Let's see now the Maharal's understanding of this. Maharal explains debate and the legitimacy of multiple different answers in a slightly different way. And that's as follows. Has anyone ever heard of the Heinz dilemma? The Heinz dilemma is basically boiled down to, do you steal to save someone's life? Do you steal to save someone's life? Okay. What's the answer?
It depends what you're stealing.
Maybe it depends what you're stealing. Okay.
Like,
it's not so clear necessarily that there is a correct answer. But that's the moral dilemma. Do you steal to save someone's life? Okay. Let's say, for argument's sake, I'm not drawing a conclusion, but let's say, for argument's sake, the right answer is to steal. Okay? Does that make stealing right? At least in this instance. Or are you no longer doing something wrong by stealing? Or are you just doing the thing that is less wrong? So do we say that when you have a moral dilemma, whatever is the right answer isn't just practically what you should be doing, but it actually obliterates anything wrong with anything that you have to do in pursuit of the ultimate truth?
No, but again, that depends. Am I stealing like medicine behind the counter? Am I stealing food? Or am I stealing like a heart from a heart transplant that I'm not supposed to get it? Like,
so let's say, for argument's sake, let's say medicine. For argument's sake, let's say medicine. Okay? So the question is like this. Are you doing the better of two evils, or does the fact that you're doing this to save someone's life mean that stealing is actually good?
It gives you a reason to like explain it to yourself, or something.
Justify yourself.
Yeah.
So even if you say that you should steal, okay, that doesn't mean, meaning the person who owns it is still losing money, right? Meaning something, there are still negative implications.
Yeah, but how much money, like if you go to a super farm and you steal something from behind the counter, they're not losing that much money.
No, but
like,
then,
as opposed to someone losing their life.
Right, so the question is, does that mean that there is now nothing wrong with this, or is just less wrong than the alternative option?
Who knows what the medicine is? Like, the medicine could have been used for someone else. Like, there could be a shortage. Like, it's different.
Then you're killing someone else.
Yeah.
So this is very pertinent for our discussion. Okay. Can you entertain that there would be a right answer on the one hand, but that one thing can be both right and wrong at the same time?
Yeah.
Right. So can you say that practically speaking, there may be one thing that you should do, but something can be both right and wrong at the same time in different ways? Or is it, no, everything is 100-0. Everything is 100-0. It's either right or it's wrong. Once it's right, there's nothing bad about it. Once it's wrong, there's nothing good about it.
I was always agree. It's like killing. It's like there's someone killing somebody else. Like you should, like a road date. Like if someone's going off,
it's not like good to kill someone.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's not good. It's one of those like no electricity. It's like good or bad. Like, I don't know, there's a lot of stuff that could be used for good, could be used for bad. Money.
Okay. So this is the heart of the Maharal's understanding of machloket. Okay. Basically, what he says is, now we need to know practically what to do, right? Because practically speaking, you can only do one thing. Okay. But theologically, you can entertain that one thing has both good elements and bad elements. And our question is not, is it all good or all bad? Our question is more, is it more good or more bad? Now let's plug this into an example within halacha. Okay, so let's say you have a cup. Okay, and the question is this cup tame, ritually impure, or is it tahor, ritually pure? And there is a debate. It's tame, it's tahor. Okay, how can they both be right? this is a case where it is one or the other. It's not yes or no. Is it tame or is it tahor? Is it usser or is it mutter? How can it be both? Explains the Maharal that tuma and tahara basically work like right and wrong, in a sense, right? Where if it's not that we are debating whether it is 100% tame or 100% tahor. Everyone agrees that there are elements of this situation which are tame. Everyone agrees that there are elements of this situation that are tahor. And our question is not whether it's 100 this or 0 that. The question is it more tame or is it more tahor? Meaning, is everyone agrees that stealing's wrong? But in this scenario, is it more wrong to steal or is it more wrong not to steal? Right? In this scenario, is this cup more tame or more tahor? The practical halacha that we conclude is which one is it more? But everyone agrees it has elements of both. Now, let's kind of take a step back and understand why this might be the case from a theological perspective, and then with this we'll finish. Okay, who sets the halachic reality of our universe and in our lives? God, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does. Okay, let's say you want to come along and explain. This is how God sees the scenario. God sees this as good. God sees this as bad. God sees this as tame. God sees this as tahor. This is how God meant to, God reads the pasuk this way. God reads the pasuk that way. What's the problem with that? Your mind is quite limited. No offense. But just, comparatively to God's. So your ability to conceptualize is limited compared to God's ability. God sees the full picture. You, in the best scenario, may see part of the picture. Okay, so how could you go about seeing more than one small piece of the picture? Ask someone else how they see it. If they see it differently than you, but they had a good methodology, they followed the right derech, so then what you're getting is now two pieces of the picture that God is seeing, right? Or if you had it before with a 50 pixel resolution, now you're seeing it with 100 pixel resolution. If you want to see it clearly, you know what you need? Another person who went about in the proper way and reached a third conclusion, and a fourth, and a fifth. until, I don't know, 70, right? Once you have everyone's positions, if they're legitimate positions, you're actually closer to seeing it how God sees it. That's a difficult concept for us to understand. Argument and debate, it can be frustrating sometimes because it comes with a lack of clarity. If there was just one opinion, I would know what to do. Yeah, that makes it simple. It doesn't make it clear. With just one opinion, you know what you have? One person fully representing how HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees it. Well, one person does not know how HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees it. If you want a better chance at seeing this how HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees it, you need two people to reflect their opinions. Then you have twice as much, you are twice as close to seeing it how HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees it. And three times, and four times, and five times. Okay? It makes it less simple, but it makes it more clear. Okay? Clarity and simplicity are not synonyms. Because reality is complex. So if you only hear one person's opinion, then you're just probably missing most of it. The value of argument within our Mesorah, it stems from a belief that one person can never understand how HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees things. We need multiple people sharing their views, and then we get a little bit closer to seeing it accurately. Now, practically speaking, what should you do? Either what we determine is the closest to the picture, or if you can integrate a lot of opinions without contradicting yourself, maybe that's the best thing to do. Right? We said that's what the Mishnah Brura's methodology was. Right? More opinions breeds confusion, but it actually brings about more clarity to how HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees something. That's the beauty of it. Okay, we'll stop here.
Thank you.
Thank you.